Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I'm now going to cover Esther, chapter 3. I will call this chapter Haman's Plot to Destroy the Jews. Our context is this. In our last chapter, King Ahasuerus, Xerxes, has chosen Esther to be his new queen. And at the end of the chapter, Mordecai, Esther's cousin, discovers a plot by Bigthan and Teresh to overthrow Xerxes. And as a result of that discovery by Mordecai, Esther tells Xerxes. Xerxes is very happy with Mordecai because of what he's done, and Bigthan and Teresh are executed. And so now we are in chapter 3 of Esther, starting with verse 1. After these events, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, and advanced him and established his authority over all the princes who were with him. After these events, this is at least 4 years after, as John Gill points out, we see in Esther 3, verse 7, that we are now in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, verse 7 says, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman. We'll get to that in a minute, but that's the 12th year. And of course, Esther was married in the 7th year. We see that in our last chapter, Esther 2:16. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus to his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. So 12th year minus 7th year is 5, and of course it's really less than 5 because Esther got married late in the 7th year of Ahasuerus' reign, and the lot was cast in the first month of the 12th year of Ahasuerus' reign. So we're talking about a little over 4 years since Esther's become king. That's where we are. After these events, what events? Well, the marriage of Esther and the discovery of Bigthan and Teresh's conspiracy, as I've just mentioned. Now, Haman is described as the son of Hammedatha the Agagite. Now, Agag was an ancient Amalekite king, as the NIV Study Bible says. The Amalekites had tried to annihilate the Israelites as they journeyed from Egypt to Israel, sort of like a pre-modern Hitler. We read about the Amalekites first on the Exodus at Rephidim when they had just left Egypt. Joshua fought with them in a famous battle. Recall, this is near Mount Sinai. Before they had gotten there, Moses lifted up his hand, and when he got tired and let his hand down, the Amalekites would start winning. Then he'd lift his hand up, and then Joshua would start winning. That's in Exodus 17. Now, God told Israel to retaliate for the Agagites' bad attitude in Deuteronomy 25:17-19. Remember what the Amalekites did to you on the journey after you left Egypt. They met you along the way and attacked all your stragglers from behind when you were tired and weary. They did not fear God. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land the Lord your God has given you to possess as an inheritance, blot out the memory of Amalek under heaven. Do not forget. But Saul did forget. He disobeyed when he spared Agag in 1 Samuel 15:9. Saul and the troops spared Agag and the best of the sheep, cattle, and choice animals, as well as the young rams and the best of everything else. They were not willing to destroy them, but they did destroy all the worthless and unwanted things. Saul apparently also spared some of Agag's offspring. We read in the time of Hezekiah, who was 716-687, long after the time of Saul, who was 11th century, 1 Chronicles 4:42-43. From them, from the sons of Simeon, 500 men went to Mount Seir, and some names are mentioned. Verse 43, they destroyed the remnant of the Amalekites who escaped and have lived there to this day. So Amalekites were still around. And of course, now we're in the 400s, probably in the 470s somewhere BC, and Haman is an Amalekite. He's still around. So Haman is sort of a symbolic figure. He stands for hatred of the Jews because the Amalekites, with their king, who is typically called Agag, just like the king of Egypt is called Pharaoh, the king of the Amalekites is called Agag. So Haman, representing the Amalekites who hate Israel, is now going to be raised up by Xerxes to hate Israel. Xerxes advanced Haman. Now, when a Persian official was favored, it was the custom that Persian kings built thrones higher than other officials. Gill gets that from the famous Greek historian Xenophon. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say such a distinction in seats was counted of vast importance in the formal court of Persia. So Haman's the first minister now. He's the big shot, and he hates the Jews. We go now to Esther 3, verses 2 through 4. All the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai neither bowed down nor paid homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why are you transgressing the king's command?" Now it was when they had spoken daily to him, and he would not listen to them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's reason would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. Now this gate, this king's gate, this doesn't mean that the servants who were there were mere porters, were mere doorkeepers. They were rather governmental officials, so these were big shots. As to what the gate looked like, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that, quote, "large mansions in the east are entered by a spacious vestibule or gateway, along the sides of which visitors sit and are received by the masters of the house. For none except the nearest relatives or special friends are admitted farther." So these are government officials talking to Mordecai. They wonder why he's not bowing down. Now, what does this bowing down mean? What does homage mean in this situation? Well, it could either mean bowing down to give Haman civil respect, or it could be bowing down to give him religious devotion and worship. Now, I'm going to work my way through the reasons why this must have been homage that was religious. Xerxes was requiring his officials to bow down to Haman as if he were a god. This is John Gill's view. Here are the reasons. First reason, this special homage was commanded by the king. The text wouldn't say that the homage was commanded. If this were ordinary civil respect, that would come as a natural matter of course. Of course they're going to give homage to somebody civilly as a sheer matter of respect. You don't need a king's edict to say that. So that's enough reason right there to show that this is homage of a religious sort that is being required by Xerxes. Now here are some reasons that Mordecai would not have refused to give mere civil homage. Jews give civil homage. Let's read in 1 Samuel 24:8. "Now afterward David arose and went out of the cave and called after Saul, saying, 'My lord the king.' And when Saul looked behind him, David bowed with his face to the ground and prostrated himself." David was not committing idolatry. He was just honoring an earthly king. Jews would do that. Another reason that Mordecai would not have refused to give mere civil homage is that Mordecai wouldn't risk not giving such civil homage. It would mean the loss of his office. It would mean the ruin of his nation. Why would he risk himself and all of the Jews whom he is going to represent by not giving a simple matter of civil respect? A third reason why Mordecai would not have refused to give mere civil homage is that a refusal to bow in civil homage would be a mere act of pride, and that's outside of Mordecai's character. This is seen as an act of conscience. He's not acting uppity because he is saying, "This guy's hired me, I'm not going to bow down to him." Lastly, to show that this was religious worship that's being required, is that the Hebrew word for homage implies divine worship. Let me read Adam Clark. Quote, "a species of divine adoration, and this is implied in the word shaka, which signifies that kind of prostration which implies the highest degree of reverence that can be paid to God or man, lying down flat on the earth with the hands and feet extended and the mouth in the dust." So, no question about it. This is idolatry that's being requested by a pagan Persian king of a devout Jewish man. Now, Mordecai had told his fellow officials the reason he's not bowing is very simple. He's a Jew, for he had told them that he was a Jew at the end of verse 4. And I'm sure he told them further that Jews just don't do idolatry because there is only one God and we shall have no other gods before thee and we shall not make any graven image, you know, the Ten Commandments. And so the officials were saying, "Well, okay, well, I wonder if that's going to stand in Haman's eyes. I wonder if Haman is going to give Mordecai an exemption from this command." Now, this was of momentous import because if Mordecai's refusal would be tolerated, there would be implications. There were a lot of other Jews who would not bow down also, as James Fawcett and Brown says, and now you've got an indigestible lump in the body politic. Are these Jews going to be special creatures who are not going to worship the emperor and the emperor's minions? This, of course, is what happened in the Roman Empire a little bit later. The Jews got special exemptions from bowing down to the emperor because the Romans realized you're just not going to make a Jew bow down to a pagan god. You're just not going to do it. So this was a big deal here as we wait for Haman's response. Now notice that Mordecai had done here what he had told Esther not to do. Remember twice in the last chapter, it was recorded that Mordecai had told Esther not to reveal her identity. And that's because, of course, people would hate the Jews. People have always hated Jews, and so he was saying, don't stick your head out there, Esther. Keep under wraps. Don't let Xerxes know you're a Jew. But now, in this situation, Mordecai was forced to reveal that he was a Jew, because if he had just kept telling his fellow officials, no, I'm not going to bow down to Haman, what would that look like? It would look like a purely political rebellion, and that would be bad business because Mordecai would have been executed for that. This is as the NIV Study Bible points out. Now, when Haman found out, of course he would find out when the officials tell him, this is going to likely aggravate Haman. As Jameson Fawcett and Brown says, that Haman was an Amalekite. He was part of a race that long hated the Jews cruelly. Now, I've got to ask a question here. When I took these notes about 10 years ago, that phrase didn't even faze me. I didn't think a thing about it when I copied it down from Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. But now I'm living in a time, because of critical race theory, where every evil thing that is done by a white person is imputed to the whole white race. Sort of like Adam's sin is imputed to the whole human race. If a white nationalist or a Nazi sympathizer shoots up somebody, well, it's white supremacy and it's white privilege and there was just a school shooting. A Latino guy did the shooting, killed 21 people. An Hispanic writer for the Los Angeles Times said this was as American as apple pie, white people shooting Latinos. Folks, you cannot blame an individual because of what race he's from. Should we blame all Germans because the Nazis sprang from German soil? I don't think so. I think that would be pretty obnoxious. So I think that I would prefer to condemn Haman because he was a murderous SOB who wanted to kill all the Jews. I don't think we ought to blame him because he was an Amalekite. Now, it very well could be that there was some kind of mystical connection, maybe, of Haman with his Amalekite ancestors. But I'm tired of people getting blamed for what members of their race do. It reminds me, I was in a Pentecostal holiness church years ago, and a white man got up and said that he was confessing his prejudice toward black people because a black man had accidentally, it was a car wreck, had run over his daughter and killed her. And because of that, he hated all black people. And he got up and says that was a sin that way. Of course it was. It was stupid to blame all people for what one black man did. It's absurd. But people love to do that. We go down to Esther 3, verses 5 through 6. When Haman saw that Mordecai neither bowed down or paid homage to him, Haman was filled with rage, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him who the people of Mordecai were. Therefore, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews, the people of Mordecai, who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus. And there we have Haman doing exactly what I said ought not to be done. You got one Jew that offends him, so he says, okay, let's kill all the Jews. Did Haman check to see if that perhaps all the other Jews in the Persian Empire might have bowed down to him, given the chance? They probably wouldn't have, but some of them would. But he didn't even bother to check. He just said, let's kill them all because of what Mordecai did. Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And Haman was absolutely powerful and absolutely corrupt. Now, here's some other reasons. Maybe he decided to kill all the Jews. He knew that all of them would refuse to give him homage. Maybe he just knew the Jews well enough to know there's no point in checking. And again, there's the reason his hatred of the Jews, because he was an Amalekite. And again, I've already told you what I think about blaming somebody because of his race. We go to Esther 3, verse 7. In the first month, which is the month Nisan, in the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, Pur, that is the lot, was cast before Haman from day to day and from month to month until the 12th month, that is the month Adar. Now, Pur means casting of lots. Pur is a Persian word for lots. And so what was done here is they're in Nisan, that's March, April, first month of the religious year, and they say, okay, let's cast a lot, yes or no, for Iyar, 1, that's April, May, Okay, the lot says, no, we're not going to kill the Jews on ER1. So let's cast another lot for ER2 and ER3 and ER4. No, no, no. Go all the way through the calendar until you get to Adar, which is the 12th month. And we finally find, we're going to see it's day 13. We finally find a day that's propitious for murdering the Jews. So that's what it meant. They cast lots day to day from month to month. Probably they would do it this way. Is it ER? No. All right, so let's go to the next month. Is it Sivan? No. They probably didn't do every single day. Is it Tamar? No, no, no. And then they got all the way down to Adar. Oh, it's Adar, yes. Now let's try Adar 1. No, Adar 2. No, Adar 3. No, dot, 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 dot. Then we get to Adar 13. Yes, this is the day. By the way, the fact that these Jewish months are named Nisan and Adar, this is evidence that a Jew wrote the book of Esther because he mentions a Jewish month. John Gill says it's probably Mordecai that wrote the book of Esther, although people debate that. Some people say Ezra, some people say Nehemiah. So the projected date of Jewish extermination is Adar, the 13th. We'll see in the next verse, or the next several verses. Well, actually, we're going to find it in verse 13 of this chapter. Let's go ahead and read that. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar. This 12th month Adar is 4 years and 2 months after Esther had been married to the king. So she had plenty of time to please him, and she kept it quiet the whole time that she was Jewish during those 4 years and 2 months. Now, one last note about the timing here. The providence of God is in this, because when they started taking lots, they did that in Nisan, the first month. The 12th month was chosen for execution day. That was 12 months later, almost 12 months later. That gave the Jews time to escape, because it gave time for Esther to work to mediate with Xerxes to stop the annihilation of the Jews. God is in charge of lots. We go now to Esther chapter 3, verses 8 through 9. Then Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from those of all other people, and they do not observe the king's laws. So it is not in the king's interest to let them remain. If it is pleasing to the king, let it be decreed that they be destroyed, and I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who carry on the king's business, to put into the king's treasuries. Now notice in verse 8 that Haman complains about the Jews, saying this, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the Persian Empire. Haman contemptuously doesn't even mention the Jews' name, a certain people. They're scattered. That's also contemptuous. He's trying to say, these people are weak. They don't even have a state. He doesn't mention the small remnant who had rebuilt the second temple in Jerusalem, because that was just a rump, a tiny remnant. And then he says to the king, Haman does, their laws are different from those of all other people. Well, yes, they were different. They had dietary laws to teach them about separation, and they themselves were separate from all the other people. That was the whole purpose of the dietary laws, actually. They didn't have idolatry. They had one God. He was invisible. He was a spirit. That's totally unlike all their pagan neighbors. So Haman was right in this respect. The Jews' laws were different. He asked the king, please let it be decreed that the Jews be destroyed. These people that worship the true God according to God's own laws, this worship which was not done by any other people that on the face of the earth, these people with different laws, please kill them. Now, if there were a judicial decree by Xerxes, that would take all the odium off Haman, because he was in effect trying to carry out a judicial massacre. That's what he was doing. Genocide. Well, that's a serious thing. And so he's trying to get the king of Persia to sign off on it, to make a law about it so that Haman will have his dirty hands clean. And then, in order to tempt Ahasuerus to go along with this, he says, I, Haman, will pay you, Xerxes, 10,000 talents of silver. Why would he say that? Well, Haman is anticipating a likely objection from Xerxes, as Gil Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown all suggest. There was going to be a lot of revenue lost to the Persian treasury because the Jews paid taxes and they were prosperous and they were hardworking and they paid a lot of money into the treasury. And so Haman is probably figuring, well, you know, if I ask Xerxes to kill the Jews, he's going to wonder about all that money he's going to lose. So Haman was so filled with hate, he was willing to pay out of his own pocket the loss, make up the loss to Xerxes so that Xerxes would go along with the massacre. Now, some suggest that Haman was planning to get himself paid back when he plundered the Jews. We read in Esther 3:13, letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. Well, it doesn't say who's going to get the plunder. It sort of sounds like that verse 13, meant the people who are actually killing the Jews are going to get the plunder, that they weren't required to hand the money over to Haman so that Haman could then hand it over to the Persian treasury. This is just a speculation. But if he's willing to pay Xerxes 10,000 talents for the privilege of murdering the Jews, this shows that Haman not only was a very hard-hearted person, but he must have also been extraordinarily wealthy. We move now to Esther 3, verses 10 through 11. Then the king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. The king said to Haman, "The silver is yours, and the people also, to do with them as you please." Now the signet ring that was given from Xerxes to Haman invites this comment from Gill, quote, "For a king to give a ring to anyone was a token and a bond of the greatest love and friendship imaginable." Now, this ring contained a privy seal so that whatever law Haman enacted, it would have the full force of Persian law. All he would have to do is stamp the law with that signet ring. Signet means a seal. In verse 11, the king said to Haman, "The silver is yours." Now, what does that mean? The silver is yours? Couple of options. Perhaps Xerxes is refusing Haman's gift. Haman offers him 10,000 talents of silver, and the king says, no, the silver is yours. Keep it. If that's true, then Xerxes was not worried about losing his revenue. I think more probably what Xerxes meant here when he says to Haman, "The silver is yours," what he's saying is, the silver of the Jews is yours. When you plunder them, take the silver, and then you will have the 10,000 talents you need to put in the Persian treasury to reimburse me for my loss of Jewish tax money. Here's what Jameson Fawcett Brown say. On the day appointed, all Jews were to be put to death and their property confiscated. Doubtless, the means by which Haman hoped to pay his stipulated tribute into the royal treasury. So Jameson Fawcett and Brown hold to that theory. I'm 50-50 on that. He could just be saying, oh, don't worry about it, Haman, take your money. But at any rate, the money is not getting in the way of the purported massacre. Xerxes says, do with them as you please. Now, it is quite apparent that here, at this juncture, Xerxes had not been told by Esther that Esther was Jewish. Because if she had told Xerxes that she was Jewish, it is unlikely that the king would say to Haman, go out and massacre the Jews, because his own wife would be Jewish. She'd be subject to getting killed by a law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be revoked. Note also that Haman probably didn't know that Esther was a Jew either. One wonders, would he have even hatched this plot if he knew that the queen was Jewish? So remember, Mordecai had told Esther to keep herself quiet as far as her ethnicity, and she had done that. We go now to Esther 3, verses 12 through 14. Then the king's scribes were summoned on the 13th day of the first month, and it was written just as Haman commanded to the king's satraps, to the governors who were over each province, and to the princes of each people, each province according to its script, each people according to its language, being written in the name of King Ahasuerus and sealed with the king's signet ring. Letters were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, and to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, women and children, in one day, the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month Adar, and to seize their possessions as plunder. Adar is December and January. A copy of the edict to be issued as law in every province was published to all the people so that they should be ready for this day. Now, the 13th of the 12th month, the 13th of Adar, is when the execution was going to be done. The king's scribes were summoned 12 months earlier on the 13th day of the first month, not the 12th month, but the first month, which is Nisan. Now, the lot had finally been cast for the execution to take place on the 13th of Adar, and that lot had been cast day by day by day in the previous year, the 12th year of Xerxes. Well, I shouldn't say the lot was cast day by day. The lot was cast in Nisan, the first month in the 12th year of Ahasuerus, and they went month by month by month till they found a good day to execute the Jews, which was the 12th month, 13th day. So let's summarize. Xerxes ruled from 486 to 465 in the 12th year of his reign, which would be about 474. Haman drew lots to see when to execute the Jews in Nisan, and then the lot decided that the good day for execution would be on the 13th day of Adar at the end of that year, which is still the 12th year of Xerxes. And in Nisan, in the 12th year of Xerxes, the king's scribes were sent out all over the empire. Letters were sent explaining about the execution that's going to take place later that year on Adar the 13th. There were 127 provinces, as we had read in Esther 1:1, and so there were 127 letters that were sent out. The letters were all in the script and the language of the provinces. Remember, script is the written characters. The script is not necessarily the same for different languages. For example, English and French are different languages, but they have the same script, the same Arabic alphabet. English and Chinese are different languages, but they have the different script. We have ABC, and they have all those funny little pictures. But all that's taken care of. Everybody knows what's going to happen. The law, the letters are sealed with the king's signet ring, which, remember, Haman now had control of that signet ring, it having been given to him by Xerxes in verse 10. Now the question is, why did Haman issue that letter to all the provinces talking about the execution of the Jews 12 months before the execution day, Adar 13? He sent the letter out in Nisan, first month, telling the provinces about the planned execution in Adar, the 12th month. Why did he do that? Well, here's some reasons. So that there would be time to get letters to all the provinces, to take care of travel time, to keep Xerxes from changing his mind. So we just sent the letters out now, so it would be too late for Xerxes to change his mind. Or maybe it was just to keep the Jews in continuous dread, to let them sweat it out for a year, knowing that trouble is coming, that death is coming. But note that Haman outfoxed himself by sending these letters out early. Now the word's out, and now Mordecai and Esther have a whole year to react and save the situation by appealing to Xerxes. And we'll see how they save the situation a little bit later, another chapter. Now the letters that were sent out told all the people in the provinces that the Jews would be subject to having their possessions plundered. Not only that, but that the Jews were to be killed. In fact, not only were some of them to be killed, they were to be annihilated, the text says here. And not only the men, but also the old men, not only the young men, but the old men, the women, the children. Genocide, folks. That's what's coming up on Adar the 13th. So get ready, folks. Now, note that the talk of plunder that was mentioned in the letter was probably necessary. This was the material incentive to get the population to do such a horrible massacre. But now, note what an insane policy Xerxes had embarked upon. It could do nothing but damage his empire, this massacre. As Adam Clark says, quote, "A more impolitic, disgraceful, and cruel measure was never formed by any government, and one would suppose that the king who ordered it must have been an idiot, and the counselors who advised it must have been madmen. But a despotic government is ever capable of extravagance and cruelty, for as it is the bane of popular freedom and happiness, so it is the disgrace of political wisdom and of all civil institutions. Despotism and tyranny in the state are the most direct curses which insulted justice can well inflict upon a sinful nation." Despotism and tyranny and injustice. It sounds like our current government in the United States of America. I won't say who's president now, but I will say that it is May the 29th, 2022, and you can go look it up, because we are facing despotism and tyranny in this country right now as I speak. And in verse 14, we see that a copy of this horrible edict was to be issued as law in every province and published to all the peoples. That means the common people. This was not just a private letter to the big shots, to the governing officials, but everybody knows about this public massacre that is coming. We go now to Esther 3:15, and we'll be finished with this chapter. "The couriers went out, and impelled by the king's command, while the decree was issued at the citadel in Susa, and while the king and Haman sat down to drink, the city of Susa was in confusion." Haman and Xerxes are drinking, perhaps at a banquet that Haman threw for the king as thanks for carrying out his request to kill the Jews. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown point out the irony. Xerxes is drinking and having a good time while his subjects are in mortal fear. Xerxes, by the way, was not noted for being a great emperor, especially after Salamis and Plataea. But it wouldn't surprise me, and so it would not surprise me that he's sitting around drinking after sending out such a ridiculous edict. Why was Susa in confusion, the Persian capital? Here's some reasons. First, there were many Jews in Susa. They were friends of the Persians, business partners with the Persians, relatives of the Persians, and we're supposed to kill them? The citizens of Susa might wonder which of their fellow citizens would become murderers themselves. In other words, it's Persians that are going to be killing Jews. What happens if the Persians get bloodlust and get so excited about stealing people's money that they turn on their fellow Persian citizens? The Persians might wonder if a mob mentality might develop which would get out of hand. Here's what Adam Clark says, quote, "Although the Jews were the only objects of this decree, yet, as it armed the populace against them, even the Persians could not hope to escape without being spoiled. When a desperate mob had begun to taste of human blood and enrich themselves with the property of the murdered. Besides, many Persian families had, no doubt, become united by intermarriages with Jewish families, and in such a massacre they would necessarily share the same fate with the Jews." So yeah, the city's in confusion. Another reason why they might be confused, as the NIV Study Bible says, is there was no apparent reason for the decree. The Persian citizenry knew nothing of the ancient hatred of the Amalekites for the Jews, if that was indeed what was driving Haman. But the Persian citizenry did know that the Jews were industrious and supportive citizens. They supported the peace and prosperity of the empire. They had done nothing wrong, so why in the world, all of a sudden, is there going to be a genocide of the Jews? Well, ladies and gentlemen, we'll see what happens after this plot of Haman. In our next chapter, chapter 4, verses 1 through 17, we will see Esther agreeing to help the Jews. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.